I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. George Orr joins me again. The filmmaker and veteran journalist is a new film, having its world premiere Sunday afternoon, the 17th of June, the 60th anniversary of the collapse of the Iron Workers Memorial Bridge, the Second Narrows to a lot of us in this part of the world. The film is called The Bridge. In it, Mr. Orr has taken never-before-seen film shot by a young draftsman who 60 years ago was documenting the construction of the span. I'll get George to tell us the story about how he found Peter Hall and how this 16mm footage has been recovered and restored. Go to the Vancouver International Film Festival's website at viff.org to get tickets for the screening, which is on at 3:30 p.m. on Sunday the 17th. There will be special guests in attendance. George Orr is a filmmaker who was last on a year ago when his previous documentary, Talk, premiered last year. He also made the 2010 Olympic documentary, Chasing the Dream, as well as other award-winning projects like Against the Current, made with the late Ross Howard. George is also a veteran journalist and educator teaching journalism at BCIT. I've seen The Bridge, and it's a great documentary. The Twitter handle is at George_Orr. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, George Orr. Mr. Orr, good morning.
Good morning. Anything I say will pale in comparison to how you describe me. So
It's all true, though, right?
So we're done here.
Yeah. You've been keeping busy because the last time you were on was just under a year ago when Talk was about to have its screening here in town. So the last year you've been busy doing this?
Finished the last project last spring. Decided I'd kind of done with big, large documentaries because it's a lot of heavy lifting for
a lot of time, too, yeah.
And there's not really a huge market for niche documentary work, and, you know, it depends on the good idea. So I stepped away, and unfortunately, I still have the habit that I got in the news business as an assignment editor of sort of reading everything. Like, I'm kind of a bottom feeder for data. Reading the Parksville Qualicum Daily News in July, and there's a story about an old guy who put up a flagpole in his little gated community, and it was a story. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the story, he mentioned that he'd worked on the Second Narrows Bridge, and he had a couple of pictures. So I phoned him and said, what have you got? And he had 3,000 feet of color film that had been in the can for 59 years, and nobody had seen any of it. And I maintained my calm, thinking, this can't be.
Yeah.
Got on a ferry, went to visit him. Lovely guy, Peter Hall and his lovely wife. Live in a quiet little, very kind of upscale waterfront village, Parksville, and he had these big cans of film.
Yeah.
And when you open a can of old film, it's either fine or there's a vinegary smell. And if there's a vinegary smell, that means the film is on its way out.
Yeah.
These were pristine. However he'd managed to keep it for, at that point, 59 years, was all there. So off we went.
What was his job during the construction?
He was a young British emigrate to Canada. He approached Dominion Bridge and said, I'm looking for a job. And they said, great. He'd studied engineering in Britain, but he was a couple of courses short. So they said, we'll hire you as a draftsman. So he was working in the drafting office. But because he had skills and expertise, because he was actually more than a draftsman, he could finish his work early. He'd have a certain amount of work to do. He could finish it early. The PR guy for Dominion Bridge was a fellow named Phil Stannard, who was an old newspaper guy from the 50s. Phil and Peter were talking, and Phil said, we're going to make a movie of this exercise, and how would you like to shoot it? So you have the time. So Peter picked up a 16mm camera. The company footed the bill for 3,000 feet of color film, and off he went. He was on the bridge deck a couple of times a week from the start of construction to the cutting of the ribbon.
So you get to see the faces, obviously, of the people who built this thing. A lot of the people who unfortunately died in the course of doing it, and then you see, you know, just what it takes to make a bridge, and I guess they didn't think it'd be a feature film or a documentary, but they would use it for the company to say promote whatever bridges they want to build elsewhere in the sort, right?
Well, it wasn't so much a company enterprise. It wasn't like the board of directors sat around and said, this is what we should do.
Yeah.
It wasn't a grand branding capture exercise.
Sure,
it was just this guy, Phil, saying, well, you got some time and I've got a budget, so how about? So it was kind of an ad hoc exercise.
Yeah.
So you watch these guys meaning the iron workers, the engineers, the constructors, the fabricators, the shippers, everybody. You watch them create and assemble. Nobody gave me a number, but several hundred thousand pieces of perfectly crafted steel. Because, with steel, you can't be kind of a quarter inch out because that won't work. So everything that connects to everything has to be precise. And so you're watching this precision exercise unfold over the course of a couple of years. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating.
And in the film, you have him, because he's a draftsman, explain some of the mechanics and the technicalities of it, which is fascinating to watch because, you know, I don't know anything about bridges. You know, it's not just building something that goes from one place to another. There's a lot of, you know, and he explains how this thing was built and how it came down.
Well, the way it was built, they started from both sides of the water. There was an old bridge across the Second Narrows, but it was sort of there was a drawbridge, mm-hmm. and it had been rammed by a ship. And the North Shore was growing really quickly. Like Vancouver in post-war Canada was just exploding. Where are we going to find land to build? Well, there's the North Shore, and the Lionsgate Bridge was two lanes. And so the government really wanted this new bridge built. And they thought six lanes. I mean, back in early 1950s when they came up with the design, six lanes was huge. Mm-hmm. That would take us into the, you know, forever.
Yeah.
And so the engineering and design of it required the best steel they could get. It was all shipped from England. So you watch the ships unload the steel. You watch it go to the foundry. And because Peter is a technician, he knows what's happening all at every stage. So you actually get to see up close all of these different elements come together to craft things at, well, it's not the foundry, it's the assembly shop uh-huh. in Burnaby, which is now the Bridge Studios. It's called the Bridge Studios because the bridge was built there. Uh-huh. And then shipped on site and then hoisted up by these giant cranes and wheedled into place by men 200 feet in the water, above the water.
So how often would he shoot in the course of his day? Would he go every day, say, and take some film?
Probably once a week, at least once a week. Mm-hmm. He was there pretty well every day because he was moving paper back and forth.
Yeah.
There were two engineers on site who were responsible for the assembly of the bridge, and he was their liaison with the office. So if they needed things sent back to the office, he'd do that. If they needed him to essentially be an errand boy when he wasn't shooting. So he was kind of on the bridge and free to shoot. And from the look of the footage, he probably shot a better part of once a week for 3 years.
Yeah, and so 3,000 feet of film, is that what you said a moment ago?
It's an hour and a half.
Yeah, and what's it like for you to see this stuff for the first time? Because I guess you got the film from Hall, and then you had it digitized, right?
He and I took it to an archivist who restored the film and digitized it and put it on a hard drive. And we went there that day. Peter took the film and went home. I went back to Vancouver. And several days later, FedEx package shows up with a little hard drive in it. And I was it was like Christmas.
Yeah.
I haven't been that excited in a long time. So I plugged it in and looked at it. And because Peter... When you're shooting film, you can't see what you're doing. You don't see the forest
from the trees, if you will. Yeah.
But you're looking through a viewfinder, so you see what the camera's pointed at, but you don't see the image necessarily. So Peter he wasn't looking at the material while he was shooting it because he wasn't getting it developed, screening it. He was just putting it in the can, literally in the mm-hmm. can. So a lot of it was out of focus. A lot of it was poorly exposed. But there was a great deal of it that maybe out of the hour and a half, maybe half an hour wasn't really very usable. But then there was all this grand stuff that was, I mean, when I started looking at this material on a laptop and thinking, oh my God, like, you're seeing men in hard hats walking on beams that are narrower than a picnic bench, mm-hmm. 200 feet in the air, carrying giant things, looking over their shoulder, not tied down, and whoa. And so the impact, once I started to look at it was a little overwhelming, actually.
Yeah. And I guess he didn't want to see it after the collapse either, right? And that's why it sort of stayed where it stayed for 59 years.
The day it collapsed, he was in the shop. He was going to head out with the camera. And the way he tells it, his supervisor said, I need you to do a little bit of work. You can't go now. You got to get the work done and then go. So he got whatever he got done, drove from the bridge assembly shop to Boundary and Hastings. And he's arrived at Boundary and Hastings, and the bridge had just gone down. It was still vibrating. So he drove down, jumped out of his car, completely horrified by what he was seeing. And he's not a professional filmmaker in any aspect. And he was terrified because men he knew were in the water and screaming, and the noise was terrifying, and it was just, it was chaos. And so he tried to shoot. But if you're in a panic and you're trying to operate a camera, the panic wins. So the shots are there, but they're really quite shaky, and they're mm-hmm. really. And he made a real effort to not shoot bodies, mm-hmm. out of respect. So there are no. He saw them, He had a lot of opportunity. He was there all afternoon, so he saw everything you can imagine that would be horrible. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't bring himself emotionally to do it. And so what there is of the collapse isn't on film. He was going to be up on the deck while they were installing a 55-ton beam out over the water. And pulling that beam up was the extra weight that brought down the bridge. So he would have been on the deck.
He would have been there.
He would have been there. The two engineers he would have been with both died, and he would have been standing beside them. So when I asked him about that, he was very emotional.
I'll bet.
And so we shot the whole process except for a couple of weeks after the bridge went down. He could not bring himself to go back.
Yeah.
And it was a couple of months where they cleaned it up and they did the investigation and stuff. So the film picks up after that and does the completion of the bridge.
Yeah. Someone who did see bodies... You talked to someone in the course of the film, right? George Garrett?
George Garrett, retired famous journalist, 43 years on the beat. I think it was year one or year two for young George. He heard on the radio, on his car radio, the bridge had gone down. So he jumped in his news cruiser, went down to the water, got a ride in a boat, and was out on the water doing stories about the collapse. He tells the story. It's not in the film, but he tells the story that the first time he was an international news guy, the first time at NBC, the big news network, picked up his story, was that story.
Yeah.
And it kind of made his mark as a journalist.
Yeah.
But he tells quite horrifying stories about being there and seeing bodies come out and everything you can imagine.
Yeah. I asked you before we started about the 16mm film. I don't know anything about film. Whether there's sound on the film itself, and you said the film.
That's right. Give it away.
Yeah. The film that Hall shot didn't have sound. But what struck me as I'm watching your film is you've taken great effort to craft a film that sounds.
Thank you.
As good as it does.
I went out and shot sound.
Yeah.
Which is really boring. I mean, it's trying to find. So when I say the word harbor, what does that sound like? Well, it sounds like about 15 different things,
yeah.
None of which are terribly accessible or terribly easily recorded because they're all birds, 100 yards off. So I spent a fair bit of time just going out and shooting sound of construction, standing around construction sites, getting construction noise and looking like I'm being interested in construction. And then I tried to match what I was hearing to what I was seeing so that it would be, because if the story without the sound doesn't work. I tried it, and I thought, because that would be the authentic, the truly authentic representation. But the reality is it's flat.
Yeah.
So I needed to create ambience and sound, and so I did.
And so you do get a sense, and I'm sure you checked this out with people who were there, what it sounded like when this thing collapsed and then in the aftermath.
The description of a number of people helped me with the notion, but I had to craft... the sound of the collapse from found objects. And it was several days' work just getting it a variety of things that mixed together at various levels, so it wasn't overwhelming and it wasn't too trebly or too bass. Mm-hmm. And so it when you watch it with the pictures, it's the best I can do to recreate the feeling and of the bridge going down. Gary Poirier, the survivor I talked to, was on the bridge. He went down, and he describes this just overwhelming sound of cannons going off in his ears. So I used that as a sort of a starting premise and then built sound from there.
Yeah. You mentioned Mr. Poirier. It's a wonderful interview you do with him in the film because nearly 60 years later, the memory of it is still clear. And it strikes such a chord with him emotionally. I mean, he can't not get choked up cry about what he witnessed that day.
He was he was 18.
Mm-hmm.
He'd decided high school and he didn't work well together. He came from a dysfunctional family. He wanted to get out and work. He became an apprentice iron worker. And as a young guy, he was sort of learning the business of iron work, got a job with Dominion Bridge. On the day of the collapse, he was up on the deck. Gary's a small guy. I would think 5'2", 5'3". And a lot of the work that gets done involves going inside a beam so that somebody's inside the beam holding the bolt and somebody's on the outside tightening it. So Gary was inside these huge beams up in the air, confined space, I get claustrophobic thinking about it, but he was fine with it.
Yeah.
He had no fear of heights. He just paid good attention. Smart guy. Sort of situationally smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been inside this beam as they were preparing it for tightening, and he had just crawled out and walked away when it went down. And his description is, I have trouble with interviews telling people how to say stuff. Like, I won't. I'll just roll tape.
Yeah.
And what comes out is what I'll use. And he and I were chatting, and then as he got into the description of the bridge, he became poetic and lyrical and emotional and started to cry, and he was in the moment. He was in the moment inside that beam. He was in the moment hitting the water and being in the water. And I thanked him for sharing this. And when he saw the final piece, he said, he was in tears when he saw the final piece, and he said, I'll be remembered because he's just a guy.
Yeah.
You know, he helped build the city, but he's just a guy. And he thought, I'll be remembered. So to me, that's the biggest compliment I can get out of all this.
Yeah. It really is moving when you hear him describe, because he does, as you said, poetically describe what the day was like.
Yeah.
It's June 17th, so it's, you know, it's a nice day here in this part of the world. And all hell breaks loose.
Yep.
There's also footage in the film that you shot 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I guess this is the 50th anniversary, the 50th yep. commemoration. So 10 years ago, did you think you were going to make something?
No, I'd actually forgotten I'd shot it. I was talking with my friend Peter about his footage, and was looking at it and thinking, well, there's elements of an interesting story here, but even interviewing Peter, it's not, I need context. And over the course of the last 20 years, I probably shot 1,000 hours of material. I taught myself how to shoot about, I guess, 25 years ago now, because... Yeah. I'm competent, the gear is not that tough, and I'm too cheap to hire a camera person.
Yeah.
And I don't direct well. Like, I don't play well with other people.
Really?
And apparently it's a problem, but not for me, mostly for other people. So June 17th, 2008, I guess.
Yeah.
I heard about the event. I went, I set up. I trained a lot of the news cameramen in Vancouver, so I'm comfortable in that milieu. I just fall in as one of them.
They were covering it because it was the 50th anniversary, and it was on. It's on the, I guess it's the south side of the bridge, right?
South side, southeast corner of the bridge.
Yeah, and there's a plaque there, and so that day they were giving speeches, I noticed that Mr. Poirier's was there as well, right?
There's a great deal of serendipity in this film, which I'm thankful for, but I've no idea where it comes from. Gary spoke at this event.
Uh-huh.
I interviewed Gary 9 years later.
Yeah.
So I could illustrate time passing.
Yeah.
Because on the 50th, he was getting old.
Yeah,
by the time you get to the 60th, he's even older. But sharp. But I shot the event. There's sort of a pro forma way you shoot an event for a television newscast. And so I sort of went out and got all. I wasn't really paying attention to what was going on so much as trying to fill in all the mechanical blanks. Crowd shots, good sound, static shots. Faces, contrast shots, old men, young people, old guys, traffic whizzing by.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to imagine, when you're shooting that stuff, you try to imagine the script you're going to write, and you fill pictures in to that script. And then you, having done that, you look for added bonuses. So I put that tape away and gave it no thought until several weeks after I got this film. And all of a sudden, the light went on. The light goes on more slowly these days. I mentioned that. The light bulb finally got twisted in, and I pulled that stuff out, and I went, oh, my God. Like, there's rescuers talking about it. There's other survivors talking about their moment in this. There's these grand faces of these old men who've lived hard lives and who are sort of in tears. There's wreaths with the memories of all 19 men who died. It was overwhelming.
Yeah.
It was like I'd found somebody else's film, only it was mine. So between that and the interviews and Peter's stuff.
It's great. It's great material that you have to work with. And one of the people that spoke at the 50th, he's a relatively young guy compared to the other people there. And I noticed his name was familiar. And it turns out that he was a kid rescuing, diving and fishing bodies out of the water, essentially. And then he went on to a very distinguished career.
Phil Newton is probably as prominent a Canadian entrepreneur and inventor as we've ever had. He's the sort of person NASA has consulted with around spacesuits and containment. Mm. And if you're in the diving world, deep diving world, Phil Newton is the go-to guy for solutions around the world. Mm-hmm. And he runs a little shop in North Vancouver with there's a sign on the door that says something. And he was a 16-year-old kid. He and another diver were heading out to pull a boat out of Deep Cove. They heard this on the radio. They went there. They were pulling bodies out of the water. They were rescuing people who were stranded and stuck. And he tells this very, very graphic story of diving down to the bottom, and there are dead men. They've been pulled down by their tool belts but held up by their life jackets. So they're on the bottom. They're facing into the current, dead, and the water, the tide is moving past them, so their hair is streaming behind them. And he describes this just horrific picture as a 16-year-old kid that he saw that marked his... So safety, I think, for him from that moment on became a keystone for his enterprises that followed.
And he's got the Order of Canada, various awards honored by this country, about 10 years ago now, Eric Jameson published a book, a history of this, and I had him on the program. And what struck me, not only the engineering things, which are fascinating to think about post-collapse, when you read that book, you do get a sense of just what that meant to this city. I mean, you spoke a moment ago about what the bridge means. I mean, it's a connection essentially for the North Shore to the rest of the area here. The collapse obviously has a great impact on how we think about bridges, how we think of iron workers and engineering. This thing for the last 60 years has had it's weighed heavily on our minds and our hearts, hasn't it?
It did. There are several schisms. One is people over 70 have a memory of where they were.
Yeah.
Pretty well anybody over 70 in this city who's still alive and cognitively ticking over knows where they were that day. They were in grade 4 in school. They were at work.
Yeah.
It was heard as far as Stanley Park. It was a loud noise.
Yeah.
And, because it was such a horrific, large story. It was the story that marked... It was the Mount St. Helens of its day.
Yeah.
Or the John F. Kennedy of its day.
Mm.
So the impact was astounding for those people. And then as we move forward through time, it was never officially called, I don't think, the Iron Workers Memorial Bridge.
Until very recently, right? 20
years. Until very recently. Yeah. But it was... we forgot.
Yeah.
You know, everybody under 60 wasn't there, doesn't know, might have heard something, probably not. I was at an event the other night talking to a couple of guys in their 40s. Never heard of it. They've lived on the North Shore their whole lives.
Yeah.
And so it's a piece of history that at the time had a profound impact, but the impact is gone. The bridge remains. It's solid. It's fine. And the story about it, except for the renaming of it as the Iron Workers Memorial, the story's kind of faded, which I thought it was... There was a serendipity to finding the film, finding all the elements, and getting this thing done for the anniversary.
Yeah, and you talked to someone in the film who worked in radio for many years in this town, who played a part in terms of how, I guess in a small way, how we sort of remember by using the name that the thing's been given. I mean, people refer to it as the Second Narrows colloquially, I guess. But when you listen to traffic reports on the radio or news stories, that took a long time for those of us in this part of the world to really get to that. I mean, the last 15, 20 years.
It did.
You know what I mean?
I talked to two radio guys.
Mm-hmm.
Red Robinson was on CKWX, which was the major radio station in the city in 1958. His uncle watched a collapse, phoned him in the control room and told him. So Red, as I think he was 19, as a young disc jockey in the afternoon, told the world in a very... terms about what was happening, and interviewed his uncle. And so Red Robinson broke the story. Jump ahead 50 years, CBC Radio brings a new 40 years. CBC Radio brings a new talk show host to town from Toronto, a fellow named Rick Clough. Yeah. Lovely guy. Interview everybody about not... He's, you and Rick are the interviewers of everybody. And he heard about the story. He knew about the story, and so he just made it an issue and a mission and changed how we talk about the bridge. Mike Harcourt, the premier, finally... Premier of the day finally made it official, and so it's now the Iron Workers Memorial Second Narrows Bridge, thanks to Rick Clough.
Officially, it's not known anything other than that, and I think we're getting to the point now where we're referring to it as the Iron Workers Bridge rather than, say, the Second Narrows. A lot of us take photos. You shoot video.
Yep.
And you've always been like that?
Video is easier. Video is lazy. Like, I can shoot an hour video and then go back and look for 2 minutes of good stuff. Whereas you take 10 pictures, you got 10 pictures.
Yeah, 10 seconds, right? Yeah.
And video is, it's the medium I always wanted to work in. I wanted to work with film. I worked with film back when there was film and TV news.
Yeah.
And it's an interestingly ephemeral area of endeavor. Like, the images exist, but they're just points of data. And they're very easily lost through, magnet or time or warpage or something. But they have such a, if you do it sufficiently well, they have such a profound impact that video can make people summon up whatever emotion the director or producer is looking to summon up. With my work, hopefully I can make you laugh if that's appropriate. I can make you cry. I can make you go, oh, I can make you fall in love. Like, with pictures and sound, to illustrate a story, I can take you to places, whereas with still pictures, I can't take you to a place. And so my interest is in crafting a story that will take you someplace so you can have the experience.
And you still shoot today, right?
I still shoot today.
Yeah, because you've got projects on the go as we speak, right?
I do, and I'm wrestling with the next generation of camera and... oh, Lord.
So does technology obviously makes it easier for... I mean, I can shoot video now with my phone.
Oh, yeah.
Technology, obviously, I guess, hastens one's desire may not be the right word, but, I mean, everyone can shoot film.
Everybody can, and, everybody pulls out their iPhone, and so nothing goes unrecorded. There is no kitten that hasn't been, kittenized.
Yeah.
The challenge is, what do you do with it? I mean, I have a collection of about 1,000 hours of film that are... that I've shot and cross-referenced and databased so that I can draw on background elements of the city, whatever they might be. If I'm going to tell a story about the former Premier Gordon Campbell, well, I got hours of Gordon Campbell doing stuff. I'm going to tell a story about police and marijuana kick-ins. I have hours of almost everything because I shot for 20 years because it was actually a retirement plan. When I turned 50, a friend who passed, this fellow Ross Howard, he and I decided we were going to make a documentary. But I had to learn how to shoot. And I thought, well, I was teaching production, so I was teaching this stuff. And I thought, best if I start doing things on my own, as opposed to, there's nothing worse than a teacher who talks about the good old days and their experience and kicks you out the door and has never really done it. So I would go out with my students and we would work together and shoot together. So hence the 1,000 hours of stuff. So I quite like it, but it's an interesting technical exercise because it's a requirement of precision in terms of white balance and focus and framing and light and composition and character and movement, and you have to think it all through in real time and anticipate. So it's a great challenge. I love it.
So when you watch movies or television shows or even television news, are you watching it differently because you actually do this stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Than, say, the rest of us? Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure how... I mean, I'm so used to watching it the way I watch it. I think everybody else does too. So when I'm watching the news with my family and I start talking about something, they'll go, what are we talking about? Because whatever had transpired wasn't something that would interest them. So I see the whole craft of pictures and sound from a fairly technical point of view.
And so you can see the artistry and the aesthetic as well when you're watching, say, a movie.
Oh, there are pictures that you see that look like they're so easily accessible, and then as you when you think about in the moment what it would take to accomplish that shot, well, it might take months of preparation to be in the right place at the right time to watch the sunrise, to watch whatever it is. So some shots are pretty, and some shots are just breathtaking. Now that I don't do breathtaking. I aspire mm-hmm. to breathtaking. I do okay, which from my perspective is fine.
I interview a lot of writers, as you know, and they say that the writing is just as much rewriting as anything else. And so as a filmmaker, is editing similar?
The story you saw was the fifth edit. Actually, you saw the fourth edit, and it was tuned up after that. So it wasn't changed substantially, but it's impossible for me to conceive of producing a film from the get-go with one cut.
Really?
Because you're trying to match pictures. You're trying to narrate everything. So you can only talk about what you can illustrate. And so you craft together a sort of a little soup of what we're going to see, what we're going to hear at the first of this thing. And then you have to come up with the script that works. And is there a verb? And is this past tense or present tense? And where's the verb? And is it the right verb? And it's a passive verb. So it's tinkering and tinkering and tinkering. So it's not like the whole thing is redrafted with one intent. It's that you sort of build a little brick house and realize it's not standing up. So you take the bricks apart and do it again and do it again.
Is that an enjoyable process for you?
Absolutely.
Really?
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. I mean, I'll find myself at 2 a.m. kind of dozing off. Like, for me, the great creative element starts about 4 p.m. I've made dinner, I've sort of done what I need to do with the day, and I will go down. I have the Grotto of Despair where I edit, and I will go down to the Grotto of Despair, and I will lose myself in the process for as long as I can stand to be there,
yeah.
until my back is saying, don't do this anymore, and I crawl off to bed. But that the creative aspect is the assembly of elements, and I love that stuff.
Yeah. The screening on the 17th, what can people expect when they go? Because I guess in the earlier part of the day, there will be a commemoration at the bridge, right?
The evening prior, the Iron Workers Union Local 97 are having an event at the villa in Burnaby.
Mm-hmm.
They call it the pin ceremony. Young men and women who graduated as iron workers from the BCIT program, that was created in the wake of the accident. The graduates and the apprentices come to this, and they are whatever the secret handshake of an iron worker is,
mm-hmm.
there will be a dinner in there. And the 60th anniversary, there are three survivors who were in the film, Norm Atkinson, Lou Lessard, and Gary Poirier, who's the feature character in the film. They'll be there. I'll show a bit of film. The next day at the bridge at 1:00, they will all assemble.
Mm-hmm.
There will be some speeches. There'll be some wreaths.
Dignitaries, of course, from the various levels of government will be there too, right?
The labor minister will probably show up.
Yeah.
The union has invited the premier and the prime minister, and they may, I mean, it's a big thing in the city,
yeah.
So it depends how the invitations land, but, you know, it will be somewhere between a big thing and a really big thing. And then, so that's at 1:00, and then the screening's at 3:30. The bridge went down at 3:40 in the afternoon, so the screening's supposed to be at 3:30, but I'm going to see if I can, there'll be survivors, there'll be rescuers, there'll be the characters in the movie will be there. Peter, who shot the film, should be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I want everybody to say a little bit, or at least be acknowledged. And then hopefully at 3:40, 60 years to the minute from when it went down, we'll push play and see the story.
Yeah. The room itself is the Van City Theater.
Yeah.
People can get tickets off the Vancouver International Film Festival's website, but, I mean, they should do so quickly, right?
They should do so quickly. As well, I'm such a technical idiot. I am creating a website called secondnarrowsbridge.com.
Mm.
And this will be available through, there will be other further screenings after this one. Actually, there will be several in Van City, but there will be further screenings after that. The North Shore Museum and Archives are very interested in participating in a series of screenings. Port of Vancouver is sort of interested. I've got various entities who will help manage and produce screenings. So people are interested, go to secondarrowsbridge.com, and hopefully, unless I kill my computer, the website will have information.
It'll have information as to the screening on the 17th as well as future screenings,
yes.
As
yeah.
Well. This desire to capture our history, as you do, and then I'm going to ask you about future projects and whether they'll draw on this archive of yours. Will they?
They'll have to. Yeah. I'm running out of energy to shoot more. Had an interesting chat last week with a gentleman who's written the book on canoe, the canoe in Canada. And he's been collecting footage, and he thinks there's a documentary, and I'm thinking, well, worth a conversation.
It's a Canadian phenomenon, the canoe, isn't it?
It's a Canadian icon.
Yeah.
In reading the book, the canoe was the first item of alien technology that British adventurers and explorers ran into that they couldn't improve on. Like, they, you know, they go to somewhere in Asia and they'd see a cart. They had a better cart.
Yeah,
you know, discovers, you know, some people somewhere had done something. They had a better thing. There was no better thing in North America than the canoe. For 200 years, the British used the canoes that they found and that they recreated. So there's a story about canoes. And, good Lord, there's a story about everything. I did this piece on the Olympics years ago, the coming of the Olympics. And I'm going to recut it. Because ultimately, I have a thesis. It starts with Expo 86. I shot a lot around there. I have a lot of footage from that. And through the coming of the Olympics, we invited the world. And the world showed up with its checkbook. And that's what happened to Vancouver.
And that's what we're contending with today, isn't it?
And so what's happened to our city is a result of us essentially opening the door to the zoo and saying to the lions, come on in. And they did. And they brought their checkbooks. And now those who've been here a long time are going, well, this isn't right. Well, yes, it is. We actually put the invitation out there. We spent a lot of money saying, hey, we're open. So, and I have 99% of that shot.
Really?
And built on paper. So that would be an easy edit.
Yeah. What keeps you motivated and going? Because a lot of people your vintage would probably just, you know, sit around and do nothing.
I can't sit around and do nothing, clearly. I'm in denial about the fact that I'm getting old. Honestly, that's it. I mean, I'm prepared to think that I'm somewhere in my early 50s until my hand shakes so badly I can't find the car keys. And until then, I have the skills, I have the ability. I'm not doing it for the money, clearly. It's like you. This is a labor of love. And so it gives me permission.
Yeah.
I mean, just like what you do, it gives me permission to phone people up. Like when I was working on the piece about talk radio, I phoned up Jim Pattison. Well, he'll never talk. Or he will. Mm-hmm. And he did. And he was a lovely guy. And but if I wasn't working on something like that, I'd probably be watching Oprah.
No, she's not. She's gone already, Dirk.
Oh, no. Well, in that case, I'd probably drink in the afternoon or something.
There you go, yeah. I looked this up. This is the fourth time you've been on the show.
Oh, yeah.
I can't thank you enough for coming in to talk about this film, because it's a great movie. And as I said a moment ago, you've done a great service in terms of preserving our history in this town, because there are too few people who do that. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate that as someone who's a junkie for history and politics and the sort. But you know, future generations, what a gift that'll be for them.
I hope so, and I hope to stick around long enough to have them tell me how much they appreciate it.
Well, long may it continue, definitely,
well,
you know.
It's been this part of the world does not. We're too young to remember our history. I went to a book signing last week. Rod Mickleber wrote a book labor history. Grand piece of work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a thorough and it's a thoughtful.
Great photos in that book.
And
yeah.
It's just a perfect capture, a highly accessible capture of BC labor history, which is formative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's selling. It's not. Yeah. People aren't buying it because they have to. People are buying it because it's a really
interesting. It's a handsome book, too. Yeah, it's nice to have, you know.
It is. And if he signs enough copies, it'll become a Canadian bestseller, even if he doesn't. And I like the idea that history can be captured. We don't see history when it's happening.
Yeah.
Like, you know, something happens in our town and we go, well, that's interesting, and we move on.
Yeah.
And the next generation looks back and goes, that's interesting. Well, the challenge from my perspective with what I do is to see it in the moment, shoot it, get it, and then figure out how to create a context and give it back. What I have to do, though, I have to find the story. So it's not just the pictures. Like when I got Peter Hall's film, that was nice, and I had interesting pictures.
Yeah.
Now I have to find a narrative that will make you sit there and eat your popcorn and stare at the screen and not look away. I have to engage you. I have to draw you in. So with a story like The Bridge, do you start with it was a lovely day? Do you start with the collapse? Do you build to the collapse? These were all creative decisions, but they have to work for the viewer. The viewer has to be, because once the viewer starts to yawn or look at their watch, you're done.
Yeah.
So it's not just history. It's history in a way that is the truth, but has a potent narrative.
Yeah.
And that's the fun, is wedding all those elements.
Now, people have seen it, like I've seen it. Have they told you that it should be longer?
No. I mean, it could have been longer, but the reality is it would just drag.
Well, I thought it was so good that I wanted it longer. I mean, that's how I felt about it when I saw it.
Well, I cut it. It's 52 minutes, and I cut it that length so that if I could find a broadcaster, mm-hmm. a commercial hour in broadcasting is about 46, 47 minutes. So I could take it down to that if I could find a broadcaster. And they all kind of looked at the idea and went, oh, no.
Mm.
So I'm leaving it at 52 minutes, but longer, and it would just kind of drag.
Mm. Well, it's a good film. And I had to look it up how many times you've been on, because I always appreciate talking to you, as I have these last few years that I've gotten to know you. You're a great friend to me, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that friendship, and all the best for this.
Thank you. It's four times. Wow.
Well, you've got a long way to go for Rafe. Rafe was on 10 times.
So, oh, okay. You know. Oh, and that's another project, Rafe.
Yeah.
Quickly? Before,
yes.
As Rafe was not well and at home and fulminating and very not well and just in a rage about topics of the day, he decided, because I'd done this piece on talk radio and I'd made him famous.
Yeah.
He couldn't be famous enough, but I helped to promote him. He decided he and I were going to write a book on talk radio. We're going to write the book.
Yeah.
And he said, you have all the stuff, because I've got, you know, hours and hours of interviews, and you've got stuff. So there's lots of stuff to get. And he said, you collect the stuff, I'll write the book. And George, you put your name on it. And he passed away a week later. So that's the thing to do, too. I haven't put a lot of thought into that, but it's something to do.
It'd be a great book, I think.
Maybe you and I should do that.
Well, you know, if I ever give this up, it's my...
Oh, no, it's an add-on. It's not an either-or. We'll talk.
VIFF.org is the website for tickets. And, of course, secondnarrowsbridge.com. For more information, George will have more information on his Twitter as well, @George_or. June 17th, that's the first screening, the world premiere of The Bridge, 3:30 p.m. at the Van City Theater downtown. It's filmmaker George Orr. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.